good morning, everybody. Bright and early Monday morning. Want to welcome you to the ITIF debate on broadband rankings and policy. And I'm Rob Atkinson, the president of ITIF, and I'm going to turn it over directly to our moderator and referee. Hopefully he's better than FIFA referees, but we will see. Tom Galvin, who is has a long background in the tech world, was a reporter, was with Cisco, and now is with head of a communications firm called 463 Communications, which does really leading edge work on communications and technology policy. So, Tom, thank you.
If we were FIFA, I was going to red card you for that bad joke, but no. Since you were so nice to me, I will be nice. Welcome, everyone. My job is very small here. I have to explain the format, intro our guests, and explain to you the topic, and remind you that we're going to vote at the beginning. So as I was here, and it turns out two of my esteemed participants here were in Cozy together right beforehand, and I went into Cozy not only because I was hungry, but they had free Wi-Fi. So I had about 20 minutes, and I'm like, I can check something really fast. So the free Wi-Fi didn't work. The Spanish croissant worked very well, I will point out. So the free Wi-Fi didn't work, so then I went to my air card that I happily get from Verizon. And it made me think, as I was sitting there, how important it was for me to feel connected at that moment. And I think in the end of the day, that's a lot of what this debate is about. So the resolution before us, and do we have that resolution up there? Is due primarily to the failure of telecom regulation, the U.S. is lagging seriously behind other countries on broadband access. And that is what we're here to discuss. You can also call this a broadband smackdown, if you'd like. The format will be as follows. We will start off, well, actually, I'm going to do the intro first so you know who I'm talking about here. So we have Sasha Meinroth here. He is the director of New America's Foundation, New America's Foundation's Open Technology Initiative, and he also coordinates the Open Source Wireless Coalition, right? We also have Matt Wood, who is the associate director of the Media Access Project, and he's active in democratic politics. I think you did both Dean, Kerry, and Obama.
I'm less active now, but which means
you're one for three.
Yes.
And he's also worked communications law in major DC firms, if I'm correct. You've already met Rob Atkinson. We all know Rob as the founder of ITIF. And then we also have George Ford, who is the co-founder of the Phoenix Project, and he was previously was chief economist of a communications provider startup in Tampa, Florida, in which we discussed he happily moved out before the housing crash there. So those are the participants. The format will go as such. We will start off with Sasha spending 5 minutes telling us why he believes
Seven minutes,
giving his side of the story on why the failure of government regulation has led to us lagging behind on broadband policy. That will be followed up by Rob getting a rebuttal question of 90 seconds, meaning he'll ask a question and Sasha will have 90 seconds to respond. Then George will go for 7 minutes, explaining why this is a more complex issue than that, which is hard to do in 7 minutes, but he'll do that. And then Sasha will give a follow-up rebuttal question. And then Matt will go 7 minutes, doing the same with a follow-up from George, then Rob, 7 minutes, followed up by Matt. I'm keeping track of this so you don't have to. And then Rob and George will get a five-minute rebuttal, and Sasha and Matt will get a five-minute rebuttal, and then we will go to your questions. And as a moderator, I love to have the audience participate, so please think of your questions, and we will make sure to get those in there. George is going to walk through two things for us. One, how to vote, and then two,
Steve, excuse me.
We're not and
Steve,
George do that.
Yeah, yeah. Steve will tell us how to vote, and then two, make sure that we're good for questions as we go on. So welcome, and we look forward to this debate.
Okay. Very briefly, we're just going to we're going to have a vote in the beginning, and then at the end. It's very, very easy. Is this like American Idol? And anybody here participates in American Idol? You have the question, the resolution statement, and there are three ways to register your opinion. You can send a text message to the number there, 99503, or get Twitter. You can use that, or you can go to the website there online, poll4.com, and submit the code that way. So it's really straightforward, and we can go to the slide, and if anybody wants to start sending text messages, if you have a preordained point of view on the subject. You can do so now. We'll see how the votes come up. And then at the end, about 5 minutes before the end, after we've heard it all out, we'll go through the process again. Okay?
And no voting by the panelists. Your standard text messaging rates apply.
I'll promise that.
All right, well, I'll get us started. The resolution I have is a little bit different, and I'll just read it. The U.S. is lagging seriously behind other countries on broadband access, and this is due primarily to a failure of U.S. telecom regulation. I repeat that because I'm going to actually focus on this first facet, documenting how the U.S. is doing when it comes to our international standing in broadband access. And while I'll touch upon sort of the regulatory factors at play, I'm actually going to leave it to my colleague, Matt Wood, to delve deeper into the current state of U.S. telecom regulation and its impact on broadband access. So I think the important question here is, what is the current state of broadband in the United States? And the overwhelming evidence is that the U.S. was a leader for the first quarter century of the Internet's existence, but our fall from number one began about 10 to 12 years ago. And today, our international ranking is middling. So OECD statistics put the U.S. at 15th in broadband penetration as of December 2009. Ookla just released data on 1.5 billion tests of actual broadband speeds. And as of late last night, the U.S. was 29th. ITIF, in fact, places the U.S. in 15th place when it comes to amongst OECD countries, when it comes to broadband access, and that's in Table 1 of their 2008 report explaining international broadband leadership. And I agree with these dire assessments. And while due to time constraints I've only provided three illustrations, what's clear is that the overwhelming preponderance of evidence is all pointing to this exact same conclusion, that the U.S. is seriously behind a growing number of other countries on broadband access. So this isn't actually about the sky is falling or imminent destruction. It's more about the slow and steady erosion of the U.S. competitiveness within an increasingly connected global economy. And what's becoming glaringly clear in recent years is that there's a much-needed interplay that has to happen between regulations and healthy free markets. And for far too long, the U.S. has actually engaged in a government regulatory environment that's been overly laissez-faire, and that this attitude has actually created massive failures across multiple different markets. So in recent years, there's been a failure of U.S. regulation, not just in telecom, but actually across a number of different market sectors, and that these markets, when left without adequate government oversight, have led to subprime mortgage derivatives and the largest economic recession since the Great Depression. They've led to deep-sea oil drilling without adequate safeguards, leading to an environmental disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. And they've led to broadband deployments that have left the poor and the rural without access to this critically important communications resource. So within telecommunications, the U.S. was one of the very last industrialized countries, and I've heard it's actually the last, I would love to hear more on that, to develop a national broadband plan. And this plan was actually only developed, this document was only developed after a mandate from Congress that the FCC had to do this. And the problem is not that the U.S. has engaged in the development of bad telecom regulations, although we could discuss and argue over that as well, but rather that we failed to keep a pace of changing economic and technological realities. So we failed to pass much-needed policies, consumer protections, broadband access, adoption, digital education support mechanisms that would, in fact, maximize the public good. And so we are facing a regulatory failure born of both inaction and inadequacy. And unfortunately, a growing list of other countries have done far better than us. They've created markets where faster broadband speeds, lower prices, higher penetration have put them in a growing competitive advantage versus the United States. Thus, coming out of a major recession caused by a massive market failure, we are a country ill-equipped to lead the world in developing a 21st century economy. And we are entering a time when communications is the single most important economic force multiplier of our age, and we're woefully under-equipped to do battle. So recent work at the Open Technology Initiative has focused on pricing and speeds among a half dozen different countries and the United States. And this research has underscored the extent of the difference amongst broadband leaders and the United States' current state of affairs. And this work is doubly important since its recent research by the FCC released last month documented, when it comes to broadband, quote, non-adopters cite cost as the main reason they do not have high-speed internet at home. So whether you look at Canada, Finland, Hong Kong, Japan, South Korea, Sweden, the UK, or a growing list of other countries, their broadband is faster and cheaper, and these countries have proactive policies in place that set parameters for their broadband markets. In the US, we still don't even know the most basic information we would need to make informed decisions as consumers and as policymakers. As examples, how much does broadband cost in different communities throughout the United States? Where does connectivity exist, and where is broadband unavailable? These are fundamental questions we don't have answers to. In fact, most consumers would be entirely unable to tell you which providers even serve their own community. And these are symptoms arising from a lack of useful information being made available to consumers. So how can one have efficient markets when only sellers have access to this information and consumers are kept completely in the dark? With systematic problems like these, I'm actually thankful that the U.S. hasn't fallen even further behind when it comes to broadband. And much like the debate over global warming, the evidence that the U.S. is lagging is overwhelming. So many of the leading broadband metrics align with this assessment, that it's remarkable that anyone would still be debating this fact. But as the debate over global warming illustrates, there are still those that seek to create uncertainty in this area. And I will finish my opening statement with a final quote that illustrates the general consensus that the U.S. is lagging seriously behind other countries on broadband access. As Rob Atkinson, my erstwhile opponent in this debate, summarized in his 2008 research report, quote, "The United States is behind in broadband deployment, speed, and price. Despite what some advocates and analysts claim, the United States is behind in broadband performance, and its rank has been falling since 2001. Thank you very much.
Turn to Rob.
So, Sasha, I'll get a chance to respond directly to the argument, but I just my question, I guess, here would be: you say essentially that the failure of laissez-faire, which I would actually fully agree with, the failure of laissez-faire, but then there's really kind of two responses to that. One is a regulatory response. One is what you would call a facilitation response. The broadband plan was principally a facilitation response. There was virtually no regulation in the broadband plan, the proposals for that. And I'm unclear whether you see the response needed as facilitation, regulation, or both.
Yeah, definitely both. We clearly have a broadband market that could be more efficient. We also have some serious major success stories in the United States that should be expanded upon and generalized to a lot more communities throughout the U.S. And I see the role of government as sort of, it's like the yin to the free market yang. They fit together, and you need this interplay in order to have the kind of competition that we need in the United States to drive down prices, to drive up speeds. And right now, I mean, the U.S.'s own statistics, the FCC, when they collected what's the state of, for example, wireline competition in the U.S., 96% of Americans live in a duopoly or a monopoly or have no provider whatsoever. And given that reality, there clearly has to be some sort of government oversight in order to provide for healthy, competitive free markets.
We now turn to George.
There's sort of two debates, I guess, we'll have today. One is whether or not the lagging behind argument is useful in a public policy context, and I think it obviously is. It is believed by many. And if I were encouraging more government action, I would certainly use it because it's effective. The other question is whether or not this serves any usefulness in an analytical analysis for policy. You can get policymakers worked up, but then they got to do something. And when they do something, they have to study the problem very carefully. Unfortunately, when we get to that point, we see how most of this sort of falls apart. I'm not going to make any strong claims about where I think we are, but I'm certainly going to make some claims about how much of what is said is utter nonsense. There's a handout on each one of your seats. You may want to have that handy as I go through this. To begin, let's start with a simple analysis of rankings. A rank is what we call a low information statistic. Okay? Ranks are for dummies, you might want to put it that way. If you look in the top left corner of the handout, you'll see four numbers, 90.312 or something like that. Three numbers that are very close together. And then you have one number that's very far away. Okay, so you've got three identical, one away. But they're not identical to a degree of order that we can't rank them. You can rank anything that, depending on the degree of precision of the statistic, whether accurate or not. If you look on the right-hand side, you see the rank 1, 2, 3, 4. Now, if you see the rank 1, 2, 3, 4, you know nothing about what's really going on other than I can't order these countries. I don't know that the first three are identical and the fourth is way behind. Okay? I can't see that. Okay? So ranks don't provide much information. If you take information and convert it into a rank, then you've dummied the data and you've lost all your information. Okay? It is ill-advised from an analytical perspective. And being the only economist and statistician here, I'll stick to the analytics. The other problem is, what is being ranked? And what is being ranked is per capita adoption, okay, or per capita connections by households and businesses. You'll see the equation on the top right-hand side. Now, this is a problem because it's not a penetration rate. Okay? You have connections divided by people. Well, if everybody's connected, would that number equal 1? The answer is no, it will not equal 1. It is not bound on the unit interval like a penetration rate should be. It's also true that if everybody had a broadband connection, every business and household, that the numbers wouldn't be the same. Every country would have a different number. I could rank those numbers, and you can see in the table beneath that where the United States ranks 20th. Okay, and there are actually very large differences in the subscription rates per capita if you assume the broadband nirvana, as I called it in my papers and testimony, that everybody has a connection. Okay? Now, what we really want to know is what the observed connection is, rate is, versus what the potential is. Okay? That is one way to think about it. I think that's still defective. That is not a measure of interest. And if I get to you, I'll tell you why I call that the George and Bobby got a chicken theory. Which may help you remember the problem. Now, if you're not convinced at that, let's look at some of these tables I've provided down here. You see households with phones and then phones per capita. Australia, New Zealand, and Spain all have identical households with phones, 97% penetration rate. Yet each phones per capita is very different, and you see huge differences in rank from 12th to 22nd in OECD rank, or ITU rank in this case, given their data, which means I've got a difference where there is no difference. This is the mathematical procedure people are using to argue we are lagging behind. Something that says there is a difference, and it's a significant difference when there's absolutely no difference at all. The same is true for broadband. If you look at the table beneath, look at Iceland and Denmark. Iceland is better than Denmark in terms of households with broadband. They're lower than Denmark in terms of broadband per 100 and rank 4 spots lower. There are some huge differences. Look at Japan and France. Japan actually has more people connected than France, more households connected than France, yet ranks 7 spots lower than it does in the broadband rankings. Okay. Now this is QED. The debate is over. Broadband per capita is a meaningless measure of comparative adoption. It is meaningless. Okay. And it has to be meaningless. It is not properly scaled. Okay, if you want to get statistical, you cannot compare something that varies from 0 to 0.76 to something that varies from 0 to 1.1 and say any number along that line I can compare and say they're different. That's not possible. Okay, they're not scaled. That's why we scale things by standard deviations to get standard normal distributions. The final point is that we don't care about the count. Okay, even if you fix all these problems, you still don't have the right thing. Because I don't care how many broadband circuits we have. I care what benefit we get from broadband adoption. What are the benefits thrown off by the connection? And this may vary substantially from country to country. And in fact, studies show that it does vary substantially from country to country, and that a connection in the United States has a GDP value of 75 times what it would have in Finland. So for every one circuit in the United States, we get 75 times the benefit of one circuit in Finland. Now, when we talk about Broadway, oh, the GDP effects, the employment effects, the depression effects, whatever it may be, these are outputs. Okay, broadband is an input. Okay, it is a general purpose technology, and everybody says that, even though they have no idea what that means. And all what a general purpose technology means is this technology affects the productivity of labor, so that a unit of labor converts more output. Okay, we don't care how many counts of the technology. We care about the productivity of the complementary inputs. Now, to summarize, there's a number of interesting questions you can see here on this spreadsheet. The George and Bobby chicken theory, what is it?
20 seconds.
George and Bobby chicken theory is if Bobby Flay and George Ford both have a chicken, I can guarantee you the output is not the same. Mm-hmm. So, and the argument we're having here is that if we both have 100 broadband circuits, the output is the same. The output is what we care about, not the input. Thank you.
Sasha.
Great. Well, as a somebody with actually a quantitative statistical background, I did read your paper, George, and it was fascinating. But what actually sort of concerned me the most was that underlying the statistics that you put out were two big assumptions. One is that, and these are quotes from your paper, broadband is likely to be deployed to and purchased first by those who value it the most. And number two, assume that the highest value users subscribe to the services first. And I'm curious, given that we do live in a country where over a dozen states have passed laws that limit the deployment of broadband so that highest value users can't purchase this, how have you taken that into account with your fundamental analyses?
Well, the question has absolutely nothing to do with what I just said. And you may know some statistics, but you don't know economics, apparently. You make the assumption, when you draw a demand curve, right, it's downward sloping. And all that says is that some people value it highly and some people value it low. Okay? So, obviously, over time, if price falls, and price is falling over time, then higher valued users adopt first because they have a higher willingness to pay. They'll pay $50 for a connection. You lower the price to 30, and you get the people who won't pay 50, but will pay 30. Okay? So this is this natural progression. Willingness to pay exceeds price, and you'll buy. If price falls over time, then naturally this happens. Now, this is just an assumption from the BAI paper, which permits you to make some integral calculations, some integral calculus, if you wanted to compute consumer surplus. Okay? Now, that's pretty high level, I guess. But the notion is, if you want to create an index of adoption that makes sense, okay, that is value-based, then you can make assumptions about the way things progress over time. Okay, and it's natural to think of progression over time, and this is in all the standard literature of innovation, which I'm sure Rob will tell you, the early adopters are those that value the most. Okay. So this is just a natural assumption from the literature, but it's an assumption to create a broadband adoption index that makes sense. It has nothing to do with the bogusness of per capita measures of adoption, which drive this debate and put us in this position of lagging.
Time's up. All right, we go to Matt.
Thanks for having me here. So Sasha focused on the first half of the question. The U.S. was lagging seriously behind other countries. I'm the lawyer here in the economists and statisticians debate. I'm not sure exactly how that will come across, but my job, I see it, is to focus on the second half, which is the failure of U.S. telecom regulation. And the problem with talking about the failure of U.S. telecom regulation is there are many different types of failures and inattentiveness that we might focus on. I don't know if there's really dispute or debate in this room about all of them. I think that there's probably agreement on some of them, and we'll see if this debate format lends itself to defining those points of agreement as well. But I'm sure there is dispute about some of them. The problem with describing it as a single failure, as I said, is there are many different areas we might point to. I guess three general categories I would look to are competition policy, transparency regulations in several different forms, and also Universal Service Fund reforms. And I'll probably start at the back and go forward because I think there's probably less disagreement on those latter two and more room to talk about the competition policy angle that I think Dr. Agatston will address as well. USF, you know, the National Broadband Plan calls for repurposing it for broadband. That is something certainly that my organization and people, I think, on all sides of the debate are in favor of. There are debates about how to do that best, of course, but that is something that has been a long time overdue. If it is really true that broadband adoption is something that is helping the world, keeping the world, the U.S. lagging in broadband, then that's something we have to look at as well. And converting Lifeline and LinkUp to a broadband support is really important, especially because broadband deployment has been available for people using USF funds. Carriers can use that money to deploy broadband-capable facilities. Lifeline and LinkUp, the consumer-side adoption supports, have not been available for broadband. And so that's something that is a problem if we want to have people actually taking service, and if service really is available to 95% of the country, as different carriers will claim. On the transparency side, Sasha talked about this briefly. I think that it's important to think about the fact that we don't know what's going on out there, and that speaks to the need for the FCC and other governmental agencies to collect their own data. You know, we've relied for quite a long time on third-party sources, especially in the wireless area, where we have, you know, people who basically started out of the kindness of their hearts or to provide their own service, and we're relying on that data to determine where we have competition or where we have service and dead spots and whatnot. We've called for the government to collect its own data. Obviously, that has been a long time in coming, and it's hard to calibrate in some ways. These are difficult questions, but we've often thought the government should require more accurate reports than what it's getting now when it comes to universal service and broadband deployment and adoption. On the side of consumer transparency, and not just simply the government collecting information from carriers and not making that available to people, we think that it is essential that the market be open and fair and functioning, and that carriers have to disclose transparently to their subscribers the types of speeds that they're getting. You know, the National Broadband Plan didn't really take up a lot of the great recommendations in OTI's work on this topic, that people be given more information than they might, quote unquote, need in the short term, because in the long term, people will come to recognize the meaningfulness of the disclosures that they get, the labels that they receive, and that, you know, simply saying this broadband provider gets 5 stars and this one gets 3 stars is not going to be very helpful in the long run, because people will not really have any meaningful information to distinguish between one provider and another. In the rare instance when there is more than one provider available for wireline services in a particular neighborhood. I think turning to the part where there will be a dispute, I would imagine this is where most of the comments will focus, is on competition policy. And there are several failures here that we could talk about. I think the primary one that you might point to is merger policy and merger review processes in this country, where the government has consistently predicted competition or expected competition to occur, you know, accepted promises from providers that they will eventually enter each other's service territories and compete against one another, and that has not come to fruition, especially in the wake of the 2005 mergers, where SBC and Verizon acquired two of their chief competitors in the form of AT&T and MCI. Competition policy also might look to things like wholesaling and to the inputs for broadband competition. You know, Sasha was kind enough to quote from previous ITIF study. The Phoenix Center obviously had been more concerned about special access and other sorts of failings in broadband inputs in the past. And quoting from Dr. Ford's paper in 2003, he said that while admittedly imperfect prognostications about competition and market power may be acceptable ex ante, continued agency review of incumbent market power is not only warranted, but virtually mandatory, and that when abstract measures of competition are found ex post to be inadequate checks on market power, such as in the case of special access services, continued use of such abstractions by regulatory agencies should be immediately reviewed and potentially eliminated. And that's from 2003, coincidentally enough, a year after the cable modem decision that is much talked about these days. We don't want to get into that whole can of worms with Title II and reclassification here, I think. But it's curious that, you know, that kind of statement was made in 2003, and that we have exactly that kind of situation going on in the wake of the classification decisions. We see many predictions of competition come from the FCC and from other agencies. Not a lot of actual competitive pressure is putting downward pressure on prices and making people disclose in the market the terms of their service that they're offering to consumers. You know, we see in the net neutrality docket comments, for example, people saying that companies should be allowed to compete on the amount of information that they provide to consumers, and they might devise things that are better than what the government can mandate. We tend to think that there should be at least some baseline disclosure, and that it's a failing of government regulation when we don't have a baseline meaningful disclosure to consumers of the type of broadband that they can get when 4 out of 5 people don't know the broadband speeds that they're getting or who's available in their neighborhood. I think the final point I would make is that these predictions about the speeds of broadband, about the competition we're likely to see, You know, you might look to intermodal competition as the solution here and say, well, we don't really care about these mergers. We don't care about AT&T and MCI being gone because intermodal competition is the way to go, and we have at least two providers in a lot of different areas, one DSL or in some cases fiber and one cable. Sasha pointed out that that's really only part of the country. You know, I think it's 78% is the number at which the FCC's broadband plan pegged the number of the amount of the country that has at least two or exactly two providers of wireline services. The intermodal competition that we see in those places is probably not very convincing either in a lot of cases or effective in a lot of cases because you have Fios being deployed, which is a great fiber-based technology, but it is something that is, Verizon is stopping and essentially capping at 25 million households around the country. Places like inner city Baltimore and Boston will not be receiving Fios deployments. And so in those places, cable, assuming the cable operator has gone to DOCSIS 3.0 and has upgraded its facilities and is providing the most robust connections that it can, cable will essentially have a monopoly in those areas on truly high-speed services in this short to medium-term time frame.
20 seconds.
So the intermodal competition that people might expect or rely on isn't really effective itself in many cases, and it's something that we don't think we can rely on at media access projects because of competition being something that is usually something where we don't say two is enough and that we can rely on other less perfect substitutes in those cases.
All right. I'll turn to George. There's a rebuttal to you.
Well, that wasn't so bad. I think Matt had some good points.
You get a question. Yeah, this is not commentary. It's a
question. The
if you just want to offer praise instead of asking.
Well,
a question.
Yeah, I just
Freeman of the farmer.
I'll save some things for later. But we have a situation where 95%, I guess 94, 95, 6% have two or fewer providers of broadband. And four out of five people don't know what their options are. Is it really worth telling people more about service when they can't figure out the names of the two companies, of two or fewer companies that are offering broadband service?
I guess we're up here.
Yep.
Is it really worth telling people more? I mean, I think that those who champion the free market, and it's something that people on our side get accused of not liking very much, although I think those claims are overblown, something that people who champion a free market should probably embrace and want to require, yes, that people have more information. I don't think that it's necessarily a failing of consumers that they don't understand what they're seeing. I mean, this is maybe speaking more ill of me than of everybody else, but you hear this all the time. You know, I'm a cable lawyer. I've actually written privacy policies and terms of service for cable companies in the past at some of those firms that was mentioned I used to work for. And, you know, when you get your monthly bill, hands up who can understand their bill. We could vote on that. Who really knows where these governmental fees are going and where these charges are going and exactly what you're paying for each service? So obviously it's not going to be easy for government either to set very specific categories of how to disclose things, but we should have some basic rules of the road and frameworks to tell people exactly what they're paying for which part of their bundle. I don't think it's because people are naturally dumb that they can't understand what their broadband provider is charging them. I think it's because the bills are, especially the website and terms of service that you see in advance in the advertisements are not very complete, and so that more information will, in fact, be better, not worse.
All right. Bob, turns.
All right, well, great. Thank you. I want to thank Sasha and Matt for being gentlemen and to debate here. There are some people who on that side who simply refuse to debate this point, so I really appreciate their willingness to do that. Sasha pointed out that we had a report in 2007, I think, explaining international broadband leadership, where we did say that U.S. is behind. I'm not going to deny that we wrote that. It was a typo, actually, in that report, I think. We did say that, but the real question, and you read the report, and I encourage you to do that, was what's that all about? A couple things. One question is who are we comparing ourselves to? So if you look in the U.S., there's a wide variety of difference between states. Some states are very high, some states are very low. Yet we compare us in Europe against individual countries. If you compare us against Europe, which we did in a report last year called the Atlantic Century, take the EU 15, the richest 15 countries in Europe, we actually lead them on broadband quality, which is speed, and on broadband adoption. So we're ahead of Europe. So I think yes, we're behind Sweden, but the leading states in the U.S. are not behind Sweden. Secondly, even when you look at individual countries and you say that's the metric, we're a lot better than I think people argue. As George alluded to or made the point, it's per household that matters. European households have very small households compared to the U.S., and if we had everybody in the U.S. that had broadband, we'd still be behind. On a household measure, we're 11th, not 15th. Okay, now you can say, well, still, we're 11th. That's not very good. The real reason we're 11th, does anybody here imagine someone buying broadband if they don't own a personal computer? The answer is no. So if you look at if we had the same level of PC ownership as the top six countries in the world in broadband access, we would actually rank fifth in world broadband adoption. Not 11th, not 15th, fifth. Only 62% of Americans have a PC at home compared to 78% in Japan, 75% in Sweden. So the real problem is not that we have bad broadband, expensive broadband, or limited broadband. The real problem is we have digital access problems, digital literacy, and people who simply don't know how to use it or won't use it. Finally, another factor here is deployment, which we're looking at adoption. The real question is deployment. According to the new OECD numbers that just came out, we have the highest cable modem coverage in the world. 96% of households can get cable modem service. Sasha talks about speed. One of the things that I think is missing in that debate is just in the last year, U.S. cable companies have been aggressively deploying what's called DOCSIS 3. 70% of U.S. households now have DOCSIS 3, which can get speeds of up to 100 megabits per second, albeit a shared network. By the end of next year, it's 82%. We also have more fiber deployment on a per household basis than Europe does, largely due to efforts by Verizon and AT&T. Let's talk about lower prices. In a prior article, Sasha in Slate talked about that the U.S. has high prices, $35 for 1 megabit, and other nations charge $20 for much faster speeds, 4, 5, 6 megabits. In reality, I went online, I looked at Verizon and AT&T, for example, and they will both sell me broadband for $19.99 a month. DSL broadband. So I don't know where they get the claim that somehow the U.S. is $35. AT&T actually charges $25 for six megs, which is certainly competitive and in the same rate as the rest of the world. The other factor here also that they would argue is, so you look at why are we behind, and they will argue that demography or geography is not the reason. So in other words, we're kind of the same as Iceland. Well, in reality, what we would argue that per capita density is not really the right measure, but what we argued is urbanicity is. In other words, the share of your population that's living in metro areas and the density of those metro areas. It is a lot cheaper to deploy high-speed broadband in densely populated metros than in Washington, D.C., where I've got fiber to the home and I have got a quarter-acre lot in Bethesda and, what, one-acre lots out in Potomac. In South Korea, for example, 50% of housing units in the country are multi-tenant, generally 25 stories, 10 to 12 to 25 stories tall. In the U.S., 3.2% of households live in buildings with more than 50 units. So that's a big, big factor. That makes it a lot easier. That's not a failure of regulation, unless you want to argue that our urban planning regulations are at fault here. Now, the main point that they will argue is that we're behind, which I would argue we are behind, but really because of factors that have nothing to do with policy. They have to do with geography. They have to do with computer ownership. But they will argue we're behind because of lack of competition. I agree 100% with Matt on the whole point of Lifeline link up. Expanding USF, we've long supported that. We also support transparency as well. We might disagree on certain factors on how to implement that, but I agree with that. The real issue is competition. We have the most intermodal competition in the world, tied with Canada. And the other point, somehow, that if you only have one provider, you're going to be hurt. All the broadband plans have regional pricing plans. There's no broadband provider that I know that charges higher because they know that they don't have a competitor in that region. They all charge regional pricing plans. So even when you have one provider, you're subject to competition. The key point on competition, though, is that they imply somehow that more competition would lead to lower prices. Well, to do that, you have to have one of two assumptions or both. One is that there's excess profits. So in other words, the idea that prices could be lowered, they're just there for the taking, and competition will lower prices, suggests on the one hand that there's excess profits. But as Larry Darby argued, showed former chief economist of the FCC, profit rates for major broadband providers are actually below the average rate of profits for U.S. business. There's no evidence that there are excess profits in the broadband marketplace. So that suggests that the only possible explanation, if it's not excess profits that keeping up prices, which I would argue prices are not high, that has to be inefficiency. That somehow competition in other countries is driving these ISP providers to be incredibly efficient. I would argue this is kind of absurd on its face. Any CEO who is CEO of a company where there's high levels of inefficiency is essentially leaving money on the table.
20 seconds.
And secondly, just if you look at data, wireline telecom productivity from 2002 to 2008 rose twice as fast as overall U.S. business productivity, clearly evidence of high levels of efficiency in that marketplace. So as I would argue, the real reason we're behind is issues around computer ownership. We have the longest loop lengths in the world, which in other words make it very, very hard to do. And lastly, other countries have put in place very large subsidies to make broadband available, particularly in low-income areas and high speeds. We have not subsidized broadband, therefore, that's a problem. Thank you.
All right. Matt, it's your turn to offer a rebuttal question. No
problem. Sure, there have been different areas that we could talk about, but I guess the last thing you talked about was loop links in this country, and you talked about DOCSIS 3.0. Is this something that we can measure? If we have a longer loop and we have many people sharing it, the entire loop is capable of 160 megabits per second. What can actual users expect to see from their broadband connection if their cable operator has upgraded to DOCSIS 3.0? I don't know if there are precise numbers on this. If there aren't, then perhaps we need to do more to study the issue. But what kind of speeds are people seeing individually when you have these incredibly long loop lengths as you characterize them?
Yeah, I mean, technically, the loop length data we have is for the copper loop. We found 13 nations with loop length data, and the U.S. had the longest, twice as long as Korea and Japan. So loop length is not quite the right measure for cable. The cable plan is a little different, not really on a loop in that sense. And even long loop lengths don't imply more households. Sort of the household serving a central office are kind of the same. So if you have short loop lengths, you have kind of the same number of people in the central office, just more concentrated. So your point is how much are these high-speed networks shared, and what's the real speeds? And I don't know the answer to that. I haven't. I'm sure there's people here who might know the answer to that from the cable industry. But clearly they're 4 to 5, 6, 7 times faster than DOCSIS 2, and represent a fairly major upgrade in U.S. speeds.
All right. Well, that concludes the first part of our debate. And we now have, each team has 5-minute rebuttal periods. Sasha and Matt will start with you. And you can sit there, or you can go up to the microphone. I'll leave it to you all on what you want to do.
I'll sit here. Just going to probably pass off.
Okay.
So can you let me know when we're 2.5 minutes in or so?
I can. Perfect. I'll just put my hand up just so you know.
Okay. Perfect. So, you know, we've covered a lot of areas here, and I'll start by saying simply that numbers don't lie. Statistics, however, is a whole other story. And what I think is really problematic is that no matter which goalposts you're using, it's very clear that we're not on a positive trajectory here in the United States. And we can argue about how fast we're sinking, but we are sinking, and it has profound implications for the future of our economy. So when we talk about how we measure these things, I think it's important to keep in mind that throughout Indian country and in rural America and communities throughout the country, people who want broadband access and are willing to pay for broadband access don't have access to any service provider. And over a dozen states have, in fact, made it illegal to build networks, or communities to build their own networks, because they're not being served by any provider whatsoever. And within that reality, I think a lot of the fundamental assumptions that go into reconceptualizing how we measure how the U.S. is doing don't hold. Now, I think where George and I fundamentally agree is that we need to collect more useful information. Can the OECD statistics be improved? You betcha. I agree 100% with that. In the same way that many of the statistics that we collect can be continually refined and improved upon. But do we then ignore the best available data that we have today? I think we do so at our own peril. And where I would hope that we still agree is that this is an area where there's been a massive failure of U.S. telecom policy, and that a regulation to collect more useful information so that George can actually create the BAI, and so that could be a part of this ongoing discussion, would benefit us all. But constantly changing the metric is a poor way to claim we're winning the broadband race. And if we're not behind, we're at least very much stagnant when it comes to where we are today. So addressing what Rob was talking about the recent research that the Open Technology Initiative has done, our numbers come from about a half dozen different countries. We provide primary sourcing to where we got them all, and we excluded specials, i.e. the six-month introductory 1995 rate that you get, which is maybe half what you'll be paying after that six-month period. But if we do want to include those, let's include France, which offers broadband connectivity for €2 a month for the first 6 months. I'll pass it off to Nick.
Yeah, I think that's a point I would have liked to make, too, is that 1995 tends to expire pretty quickly, and then after that, you're oftentimes locked in for another year at a substantially higher rate. So when we look at advertised prices again, apples-to-apples comparisons are difficult because of different technologies. Maybe some of those problems are intractable, but there are issues of just looking at what people say they're selling and drawing conclusions from that. I think that if the costs really aren't that high, then what are we to make of people who say that cost is one of the reasons they don't adopt broadband? Perhaps those people are uninformed, and perhaps throwing more information at them, as George suggested earlier, is not going to produce good results, but I think we would beg to differ on that. But giving people more information and bringing prices down when people cite the price as a primary reason they can't adopt broadband would be a useful outcome for our society. If prices really aren't high, then the question maybe is less relevant. But if prices are high and competition won't lower them, as Rob suggested at the end, what are we to do? Is this Taft-era monopoly telephone regulation that is such a bugaboo that we hear about, Title II regulation is so scary, is that really inappropriate for the broadband marketplace? If it's really a marketplace where, you know, cost is impeding adoption, and where competition is not going to work to reduce costs, because to reduce prices of people, because there's just something about the broadband market that makes it different, whether it's high capital costs at the outset or not. Finally, the adoption point I think maybe is lost a little bit here, because we're talking about broadband availability, but it is something that, you know, we agree that broadband is available to most of the country. It's just a question of how good it is and how good it is compared to what people have available in other countries. When it comes to PC ownership and digital literacy, very much in favor of Media Access Project, as are many of our allies, in providing new subsidies for those kinds of services. But I have to wonder how much people on the other side of the table or people in industry are willing to set aside new outlays from Congress and provide for basically new subsidies, new taxes. Rob kind of left off at that point, saying other countries have massively subsidized this, and he pointed himself to the low PC ownership levels that might contribute to lower adoption in this country. My question would be, what do we do about that? Are we going to do something about that, or are we simply going to say rankings don't matter, and therefore we don't have to do anything to address these digital literacy and digital divide questions?
Rob and George, you have 5 minutes.
Okay. Well, a couple of things just to make a point. The AT&T and Verizon rates are not special rates. They're actually lifetime rates. So you sign up, you get $19.99 for life, including when there's inflation in the future. This issue, I think that Matt pointed out, about somehow there's something about this market that competition won't reduce costs. That's because there are already low profits in the industry and high levels of efficiency. It has nothing to do with the nature of the market. It has to do with the industry right now is incredibly efficient. The only way you reduce costs is to essentially subsidize it, because the costs are about as low, the real prices, I should say, the costs are about as low as you can get. There's no evidence that somehow that there's excess costs or excess profits going on here. So this notion, the reason things might cost a little more here, is a pretty simple and straightforward one. In France, if you want to upgrade your network to VDSL, you pay $100, and you're the ISP, you pay $100 for a VDSL modem in your central office, I mean, in upgrading your central office. In the U.S., you have to pay a minimum of $700 to serve that home with fiber to the home or fiber to the node. So you get a, essentially, assuming a 40% adoption rate, which is very, very generous, you're going to be at a capital cost of 7%. ISPs in the U.S. get a 15-year payback to upgrade their networks to higher speeds. French ISPs get a payback in less than 2 years. It simply is much harder to do this in the U.S. And I think we have to recognize the uniqueness of the U.S. marketplace of low density and high levels of digital illiteracy. So I would agree that the real issue we have to focus on, I would argue, is direct subsidies. I think the plan could have been much more aggressive on saying we're going to subsidize low-income people, we're going to get more computer ownership, we're going to do more to get high-cost areas. But that's addressing market failures. That's not addressing ISP failures because there aren't any.
It's hard to know where to start at this point. Numbers don't lie. People lie. Okay, look at the numbers on this table. The OECD broadband rankings are a lie, plain and simple. Okay, they do not tell the truth. The other problem we've got with this, we're falling thing, okay, and this is because we were ranked fourth and ranked. What were we supposed to rank? I mean, in the long run, equilibrium, what are we supposed to rank? Okay, if we rank fourth, we sort of were the first guys to do broadband. Of course we're going to be ranked high. That's a benefit to the country. 15th is about right, man. We're going to be 15th. I don't care what the FCC does. We're going to be about 15th. Okay? What's going to happen when we spend $7 billion a year for 10 years and we're still 15th? We're going to look pretty stupid. Okay? Because we are fundamentally in that spot, okay, because of our demographics, our household size, and so forth. The second problem with these arguments is this nirvana attitude about government. Okay? On the one hand, well, the government failed to regulate the financial sector. We have plenty of regulators for the financial sector. The government failed to regulate the drilling. We have people, apparently purchased by the oil company, who regulate drilling. Okay? We have an FCC, and we're criticizing the FCC. What FCC is going to make these new decisions? Because it's obviously the one we have, because they screw everything up. Right? Where's this nirvana government that can solve any problem? I mean, they're the worst problem solvers on the planet, okay? So it's kind of weird. The other thing is demand curve slope downward. I don't care where you are. Somebody's going to say price is the problem. As long as the price is positive, price is the problem. In fact, some people in this country would require payment to subscribe to broadband. Because you know, what a broadband circuit does is it brings every freak in the world into your house. If you have children, you realize what a problem that is. And there are plenty of people in the state of Alabama, one of the number one reasons people don't subscribe to broadband is because they do not want to bring pornography into their house. Okay? Some people just don't want it. Zero is never the right number, and 100% is never the right number. There are going to be people in this country who do not have broadband by their own choice, and there will be people who can't afford it because they can't afford gas to get to work. Okay? I had a good friend of mine, who I didn't know about this, who couldn't afford a $20 copay to get medication, go to the doctor to get medication to treat the MRSA that was eating his skin. And you want this guy to subscribe to broadband so we can watch some YouTube or something? I mean, you know, get out of the beltway. There are poor people in this country. And the other thing is these speed things. You choose the speed. Okay, you cannot look at an average speed in the country and say something about it. Because you get this menu of selections, and I say, my company offers me 25 megabits. I don't buy it. I don't need it. I need 5. Okay, I'm more than happy with that. And that is a choice.
Time. All right. Well, we went from oil policy failures to MRSA. I don't know where to start with all that. Woo! Is there anyone in the audience who has a question? And I will kick it off. So, before we get going, I want George to explain OECD numbers as a lie. So they're a known untruth, and the first thing I should do is turn on the mic. That's not right.
Green.
So they're a known untruth, intent to deceive. Is that what you're saying?
I don't believe
that's what a lie is.
Okay. The numbers do not lie. People lie. Okay, and it's the use of the numbers. A broadband per capita, it can be an interesting number for statistical analysis or something, as long as you make some adjustments to account. I believe the broadband, or any telephone's connections per capita, is a deeply flawed measure that a lot of people use statistically, and it could cause some serious problems if you don't have other adjustments. But what I'm saying is there a lie, is that when you say that being 15 implies that you're worse than somebody else, in terms of your broadband adoption. And you can look at this table on the handout and you can see Japan and France. Japan has more households with broadband than France,
yet ranks 7 spots below in the per capita rankings. Now, what the OECD should say, and they refuse to say, is that the per capita rank is an index that should not be used to suggest that one country has more broadband subscription than another.
Thank you. All right, so I'm going to let you guys follow up on that. Do you think the number, the rankings matter, and are they a lie?
Clearly, rankings do matter, and they are important indicators. I would say that they are incomplete and can be refined and improved upon. That's entirely different from saying that they are a lie or should be dismissed outright. We have to move forward based upon the best available data that is in the public domain today. This is one of those data sets that's out there that we can utilize. I would love to see more information available so that we could develop more advanced, if you will, ranking procedures. But right now, those don't exist. And so when I look at this, and when I look at the prices that we're paying in the United States, which are significantly higher than people in other countries pay, and when I look at speeds in the United States, which are significantly lower than a growing list of other countries, and when I look at population density of the United States, which is claimed to be the reason why this differential exists, what confuses me is that 5 of the 14 countries that are out in those OECD statistics that are ahead of us have far lower population densities than the United States, and that is not accounted for right now.
All right, so in the course of this debate, we heard a lot of generalities about policy, including on competition policy. So, Sasha and Matt, what specific policies would you put in place? And then Rob and George, I'm going to ask you to respond to those and if those would be a bad idea. So tell us what specific policies you would put in place to address what you see as a shortcoming and a lack of adoption and everything else that come up attached to that.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I pointed to, and I don't know if it's entirely fair, but it's not an ongoing policy decision, but the merger review processes in this country have been, I would say, pretty laissez-faire. You used Sasha's term earlier. EC claims in merger documents that by allowing consolidation will improve competition because everybody else will have to try harder to keep up. Those are the kinds of things I think should not really fly, and we hope to see a renewed emphasis on consolidation and competitive analysis when companies do get together. I mean, you look at the 2005 mergers when basically the rationale, one of the rationales offered for allowing Verizon and AT&T to buy their competitors was that these guys are no longer a marketing service anyway, so it was sort of a giving up kind of mentality. On the USF side, we do want to see USF, it's a difficult question, but funding competition is something that has been claimed as the reason the fund is growing out of control. Of course, if you don't fund competition and don't provide different options for people in different territories and provide wireless and wireline to people in rural areas or underserved areas, you're not providing the same or comparable types of service that you're seeing.
Specifically, what kind of policies would you want to see in terms of funding competition?
Funding competition, I think that we would like to see that there are funds available on a technology and platform-neutral basis, and that you don't simply have a one-time-only investment in wireless. The broadband plan proposes a catch-up to get people up to speed on 3G when it comes to wireless. Now, we don't think that wireless is a perfect competitor to wireline because it's so much slower, and 4G is not promised that doesn't have the promise of closing that gap immediately, but that we do want to see potentially people able to have ongoing supports for wireless broadband because although it's not a perfect substitute, it is something that people can latch onto if they don't have wireline competition available to them.
All right. So, George and Rob, we heard specifically funding competition and merger policy. What would be the impact of those two? Are they generally sound ideas, or are they going to have an adverse impact?
Well, let me just make the point quickly on population density. We agree population density, is not the right measure. It's not population density, it's urbanicity. And on urbanicity, we are way, way behind. I just don't agree with Matt on merger review. The real competition is not between AT&T and Verizon. It's between Verizon and Comcast here and AT&T and cable, Time Warner somewhere else. It really makes no difference whether we have one cable company in the U.S. and one telecom DSL fiber company. It's irrelevant. In fact, one can make a very strong case that mergers end up reducing costs of providing these services and therefore lead to better service and the ability to invest in CapEx and all this. There is just simply, I have yet to hear from the other side the logic or the argument as to how intramodal, how more intramodal competition will lower prices. I have yet to hear that. And until I hear that argument, I'm not going to be convinced.
All right.
On the, well, let's
please
respond
go.
To the subsidizing competition. That is the dumbest idea on the planet. You cannot take subsidy dollars to create a competitor and come out ahead. It is impossible from a welfare perspective. Every dollar that prices come down is a dollar that you've got to go tax somebody to subsidize the firm. Okay? You only subsidize where you don't make money doing it. Okay, which means if you don't make money doing it, somebody's got to write you a check for the difference. And if you cut prices 5%, now you're losing more money. You need a bigger check to be in business. And where do you get that money? You go get it from somebody else, some other customer somewhere. In the end, there is no gain to subsidized competition. It is a net loss to society. It is a really goofy idea that just is completely void of economic logic or just common sense, really.
So George just said you lack common sense, you're goofy, and it's the dumbest idea he's ever heard. Other than that, what do you think of what he said, and why don't you give a rebuttal?
It's a little difficult to respond in kind, because I wouldn't do that usually. When Rob talks about subsidizing broadband adoption because our digital literacy rates are low, I don't think he's talking about making money off of that. Nobody is talking about making money from providing computers to people directly, but when we talk about the GDP benefits of broadband, of having greater adoption, of having more choices for people, of looking at broadband as an input for people's activities who then use broadband productively. I mean, everybody's an edge company now. We often focus on edge companies like Google and Amazon and Yahoo, but the phone companies themselves and the cable companies are edge companies when they provide services using those facilities. Mom and pop businesses down to that level are people who are benefiting from more broadband connectivity. So I don't really know how to respond to the dumbest and goofy tags. You know, we'll leave that to the audience, I suppose, but I do think that we're talking about different things when we're talking about how to subsidize, if not competition in each and every area, then at least having different kinds of offerings and different kinds of technologies and choices available for people in the same service territory.
Okay. When the audience has questions, just raise your hand and I will call on you. George, I wanted to go back to something. Oh, excuse me, where is it? Thank you, sir. Do me a favor. Yes, you do. Introduce yourself. Introduce yourself and then ask your question.
Good morning. My name is Kerry Hinton. I'm with the D.C. Public Service Commission. There's been several comments, Dr. Ford, as well as some of the other panelists have made regarding pricing and speed. It's my understanding that in many European as well as Asian countries, there's a common pricing model that's used for service that is not based on higher price for the higher speed that you receive, whereas in the United States, that is generally the pricing model that in the European and the Asian countries, there's not pricing based on speed, but it's based on volume usage. Whereas the United States, if we're talking about wireline, not wireless, is primarily based on the higher speed, the more you pay. So my question is part of the problem because of the pricing models that are generally used? There are some exceptions, of course, some tests that have been done. But in general, is it part of the problem with shall we say the metrics that we've been looking at regarding availability of speed, adoption of higher speed rates, because it's frankly too expensive for residential consumers?
Kerry, just a couple quick things. One is, when, as I said before, for the U.S. to get higher speeds, we just simply have U.S. ISPs just simply have to put a lot more capex in the ground than other countries who have relatively short lengths. In France, you just go into the sewer system and you're good to go. So I think that's part of it. I 100% agree with you though that the pricing model could be different. The problem is when U.S. ISPs have tried to shift the pricing model, in particular, Time Warner tried to do a pilot program where they would have bit caps. They were universally criticized by people on the left side of this debate, arguing that this was inappropriate. Most other countries, the majority of countries, have bit caps and bit pricing, and that gives them the ability to give higher speeds and not worry that they're going to be bandwidth hogs. So unless we acknowledge that, accept that, and say, bit caps and bit pricing on peak usage is acceptable, then I think you're right. I think it will be harder to get higher speeds at lower prices.
You don't want to jump in on that?
So Rob is correct. Other countries often have implemented bit caps, and they've done so at 1 to 2 orders of magnitude higher than what we have here in the United States. So in the U.S., for example, AT&T has just announced you have a 2 gig bit cap, which to translate that into normal speak, that means you can watch about 1 hour of HD film on your wireless connection per month, which, as you know, is not going to get you very far. In Japan, we've been looking at rates that are somewhere in the 100 to 200 gig bit cap. But I'd also like to address this intramodal competition and how it lowers prices. In the U.S., it is correct. We have one of the largest cable plant build-outs of any country in the world. A lot of other countries decided, wow, why build two completely redundant networks when we can have just one and have competition over that one wire? And as was mentioned, when you have that kind of sunk costs in the United States for an entirely redundant system, somebody has to pay for it. And the answer is, we do. It's one of the reasons why we pay more per month than other countries. And that's just one way in which intramodal competition will lower costs to end users.
Just one quick follow-on to, excuse me, the bit caps.
Sure.
I think that another problem with that system here is that oftentimes people are penalized for going over that at multiples that far exceed the actual cost of providing the additional text message or megabyte of data. So that if we had a cost-based system where you were not penalized and suddenly paying 20 times the amount you paid as long as you stay, you know, 1 megabyte under that limit, then caps might work more fairly here, and if people actually knew what they were paying for when they were approaching their limits, and that if they went over those limits, they wouldn't be suddenly playing a whole different ballgame when it comes to the amount they're paying per text message, per megabyte, per hour of HD video that they happen to want to stream or download.
Rob, you wanted to
Yeah, I mean, just a couple of things. The notion, I mean, look, the reason, one of the reasons why the Europeans don't have intermodal competition is because they let the incumbent telephone companies own the cable plant. Own the cable companies, and therefore no one in their right mind would cannibalize their existing revenue. That's why the Germans, the French, and the Netherlands were so slow to roll out intermodal competition, because they had a fundamentally flawed regulatory system, and luckily we didn't go down that path. Sure, there are higher costs with having two networks, there's no question about that, but somehow to say that intermodal competition will lower the cost would somehow imply that we would destroy one of the networks. I guess we'll just flip a coin and that one gets destroyed, and somehow those costs aren't sunk anymore, that we would be able to have. In other words, the costs are sunk. We already have what we have, and the idea of somehow shifting to intermodal, and who's going to go first? By anybody want to volunteer? Should we vote to get rid of DSL and telephones or cable? Which one should we get rid of? We could do a vote here and we could say pick one. So that's not going to happen.
Can we do that on there?
Last point, by the way, on yes, you have to have bid caps on wireless systems, and the bid caps have to be much lower than on wireline systems. Japan's bid cap is the wireline bid cap. Ours was wireless here.
George, I need to jump to the next question. So there's a question from the audience, which undoubtedly is watching this over broadband. Given the infrastructure realities of our, quote, wide open spaces, what policy focus should the government take despite U.S. adoption issues, George pointed out? I'm going to turn it over to you guys. I'll repeat the question if you want me to.
Yeah, we can look at what's worked in other countries with lower population densities than the United States, with lower urbanization rates than the United States. And, you know, they use a variety of different metrics. They, in essence, have a broadband universal service fund in the same way that we have a telephone universal service fund, and are thinking about, at this point in time, having a broadband universal service fund. Let's hope that reform does in fact go through. But, you know, Sweden, for example, said, hey, if you want to serve the cities, then you also have to serve the regions around those cities, the rural areas around those cities. And, you know, in essence, in broadband in the United States, people are making huge profits today. They're making over 10% profits. And I'd be okay with them making 9% or 8% profits. Still very profitable, much better than any of my investments in recent years. But I'd love to see that kind of onus placed on companies, that they can't cherry pick. Because when they cherry pick, what ends up happening is systematically, you know, the logic of the market is you go to the places that provide you with the greatest profits first. And those that get left out are systematically disenfranchised. And we cannot afford to do that.
One of the points I tried to sound earlier was that when we talk about the failure of U.S. telecom regulation, it's hard to narrow it down to one particular failure or in which, you know, a different type of regulation might arguably achieve better results. Moving away from the federal scene, one thing that cable operators often fail to talk about when they talk about their tremendous coverage throughout the country and how many, what percentage of residential households they reach, is that the reason they reached so many people was due to build-out requirements that were imposed at the local level, thanks to the federal-local split when it comes to franchising jurisdiction for cable operators. The phone companies came along and wanted to get into the game quicker when it came to video, and so they got state-issued franchises, and those do not generally have the same kinds of robust build-out requirements that are tied to population density, saying you must build out down to a certain level of population density. Initially, cable operators fought those and said, you know, we don't want to be playing on an unlevel playing field. Then they realized, wait a minute, if we can get a hold of these for ourselves, then we can avoid obligations that we've had to live with before. And, you know, the plant is out there, but when it comes to upgrading to DOCSIS 3.0, it might be mostly a software upgrade, but they're not required to do that by these sort of local and sometimes state-level obligations that they had previously. So the federal and local systems working together have both contributed to this laissez-faire inattention to policies that really got us to the place that we started at 15 years ago.
I think if I don't let George respond, he's going to have an aneurysm, so we'll turn to George.
Just by the time I get calmed down, you know. Huge profits. We recently did a perspective on this. They don't. Okay, you go to Wall Street and find me somebody that says, oh, yeah, let's throw money at telecom. It's just a giant profit stream. I mean, it's a joke. These guys struggle to get money. It's a very risky business, particularly right now with the, you know, with a lot of regulatory uncertainty and trading off regulatory certainty for financial uncertainty, which is what the SEC recently proposed. This is not a gravy business, man. I mean, we just had a huge cable company come out of bankruptcy. They don't make lots and lots of money, and they're engaged in a high sunk cost. I mean, they build that plant, it's there. It doesn't do anything else. I can't take the trucks and get in some other business or something like that. So it's not. It's a very risky business. It's not. You know, if it was that profitable, somebody else would be willing to do it, and nobody else wants to do it.
Just a quick point on the profit point. We calculated on a back of the envelope calculation. If you reduce profits by half of typical telecom broadband provider, that the bill would go down by $1 a month. So that doesn't strike me as a way to drive adoption, $1 a month less. And by the way, if you reduce the profits, you're going to have less investment. Another point Sasha made about forcing the incumbents to build in Sweden in rural areas. What Sweden actually did was in the 2002-2001 recession, they put a stimulus package in place that was essentially 4.5 times larger than our stimulus package in the Recovery Act on a per GDP basis. So the Swedes invested $32 billion, in other words, on a per, comparing them to us, if we were them, we would have had to match that $32 billion for rural broadband in Sweden. That's why Sweden has really good rural broadband. If we invested $32 billion in the Recovery Act, as the FCC broadband plan showed, we would have much better rural coverage. So it's not because somehow they forced them to do it, or their companies are more enlightened, or they have more competition. It's plain out $32 billion of subsidy rate.
You all wanted to respond?
George was wondering where we got these numbers. I would point you to the SEC Forms 10-Ks. Those are the forms that they're required by law these companies to put in that show profits, five-year average profits. This includes the entire economic downturn. Quest 6.1%, Verizon 7.3%, AT&T 10.5%. So these are where the numbers are coming from the official documents from these companies.
Well, I can't wait to buy those stocks.
George, let me finish, please.
Yeah, and you know, if, as Rob states, other countries have invested in broadband and are doing better, shouldn't we do better and invest more? I mean, I think we're in agreement that we should. I think we're in agreement that the National Broadband Plan should have provided a lot more stimulus funding for broadband deployment in the United States, so that we could look and see that our rural areas are as well covered as those in places like Sweden.
I think three of us are in agreement, potentially. I think, you know, George would tell us that it's dumb to invest because we'll still be 15th 10 years from now. So I don't know if there's a disagreement that, you know, resides further to my right than the middle of the podium here. These countries are investing more and seeing results from it. If rankings are meaningless, then I guess, you know, the debate's over, and we can just say, well, why do they rankings if they're meaningless and they're false and they're lies? But if investing more in Sweden does result in better rural coverage, then we have to talk about investing more here, and whether we're doing that for purpose of rankings or better productivity or better outputs, it seems like that's still a wise policy if we agree that, you know, having better broadband is worthwhile no matter how we rank it or measure it.
That's exactly the point. Exactly the point.
Yeah, I came back
if we invest, we don't change in rank. So what does rank tell us? Is investing a good policy? So let's say yes. It doesn't change our rank. So what does rank tell us? It tells us nothing. It doesn't tell us what to do policy-wise, because when we do good policy, the rank doesn't change or change by much. I mean, is Mexico going to do nothing because it will never rank first? I mean, it could implement policies that double its expected subscription rate and have fiber optics, and it'd still be 26th or whatever. Is it a stupid idea to do? That's exactly my point.
We got a question in the audience.
Rich Clark.
Could you please answer?
Rich Clark, AT&T. What I hear a lot of people arguing about seems to be flitting back and forth between various different goals. Some of the argument seems to be over, are we behind in penetration? Some, are we behind in pricing? Some, are we behind in capabilities or speeds or things like this? And, you know, it seems like the way people can choose to win the argument is to find what the metric is. That, you know, Japan has got a great network, a lot of fiber, very cheap. However, its penetration ranks behind the U.S. on the OECD rankings. Korea's got another great network, very fast fiber, again, relatively cheap. Well, they also have a Communication Standards Commission. The government pretty much bought that network, and that Standards Commission kind of has substantial censorship rights over what goes over the internet there. As Mr. Hinton was talking about, well, you know, some people value speed, but maybe the amount of total bandwidth monthly that you get, you know, happens. And I'm just wondering whether, you know, it's possible to look at the whole summation of these things and come to some view as to what the status of the United States is, as opposed to flitting back and forth between focusing on one or the other.
Thank you. We're going to run out of time, so if there's one response on each side, we'll allow that, and then we'll move on to the voting.
Yeah, I guess I would just argue that the problem with this debate, I would argue, is that it has ended up essentially being used to support positions, policy positions, and the data and the analysis get framed in that way. And to me, the question is, what is the right policies we need to do so that we move ahead? Now, whether we move ahead in ranking or not, or we just move ahead and have better broadband in the U.S. for more people, those to me are a set of policies around what we would call, or what I would call, facilitation. And that's really what the broadband plan said. More digital literacy, more public purpose like health IT, more support for rural broadband. I think they could have gone further, but still in all, that's the direction to go in. And that's a very different kind of analysis and prescription than saying that the failure is a regulatory failure due to lack of competition. And I think they're completely different. I support the first. I don't support the second.
Sasha and Matt?
Sure. So it was just announced, I think, yesterday that Australia is investing $11 billion to buy one of the major providers and provide intramodal competition. And I view it as, like, imagine you're in a race and everyone around you decides to speed up. I think the smart move is to speed up as well. And the only way we get there, the only way we can speed up is to invest in broadband. And I see this as a clear indicator of, like, rankings do matter. When we fall behind further and further, it has real ramifications for the future of our economy. And the smartest thing we can do is to, at the very least, keep pace with a growing list of other countries.
Right. Thank you very much. We're going to now go to the voting portion. So you've heard the debate on both sides, and we're going to be curious to see where people come out. I'm going to hand it over to talk through the, for anyone who may have missed how to do that.
Okay, this is mostly for the folks watching online because it's not as clear here. What you'll do is you'll text the code 22333. And then if you agree with the statement, you type in 34542. If you disagree, it's 34542. 5-4-8. And if you just don't know after this enlightening debate, it's 3-4-6-5-8. So why don't we just take a minute here and see how folks come out, and then maybe we can have some final comments, okay? So you're going to share the original ones with us?
Yeah. As soon as we're done with your time.
It's getting closer.
I think you can only vote once, so if there's you know, something legitimate here, it locks you out if you try to vote again.
The website is also not working. You can't submit it through invalid code.
On the website.
Yeah.
I've got text messages that I can't vote anymore. I'm no voter. Do it the first time.
If you can't vote more than once, how's it like American Idol?
First thing. You type in 4-4 and you go in and says this is not a registered entry.
Oh, boy.
So you have to
failure.
Voter fraud.
Yeah, you're voting or you're working
though. Somebody's getting
it's like we're in Florida all over.
Somebody gets to vote.
Someone's vote because right now it's tied. We're good? Okay. Well, the first votes were...
Well, you go ahead.
I think it was the pre-debate vote was 40 agree and 60 disagree with no unsure. So I'd like to thank the participants for confusing a lot of people. No. It looks like it's finishing up differently, where we're about 55% agree with the supposition that... there's a failure of government regulation, and about 35% disagree with that, and about 10% are unclear. So that will conclude our debate. I want to thank everyone for coming. This is an issue that, for all of us who've been involved in technology for the period of time we have, over the last 10, 20 years, has bedeviled policymakers. I don't think this is going to go away, and so we're going to watch this closely. I would point out one thing that... there was a news story yesterday that said that for the first time it had been expected for 2 years that China was about to pass the United States in manufacturing, which had been expected for the last few years. And it struck me that 110 years ago we would have been having a debate about precision manufacturing, because that was essentially the tool of the time that drove manufacturing and drove its... So this does matter ultimately about what our policies are, and that's why this is such an important topic, and that's why, one, we thank our participants, so we can give them a round of applause. Two, we thank you for participating today. So thank you and have a great day.